Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the IBM WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Conference Call. Today's call is being recorded. Now, for opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Christy Snyder. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Steve, and welcome to today's WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. My name is Christy Snyder, and I will be the moderator for this call. This call is being recorded, and within 24 to 48 hours, an MP3 file and presentation will be available on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. You may replay it at your convenience. If you have not yet joined the e-meeting, please do so now. An e-meeting URL is available to you from the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. If you are unable to access the e-meeting at this time, you may access the presentation from the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site or by going to any IBM.com site and typing 700-7146 in the search box in the black section at the very top of the page. You may also instant message the co-moderator, Rick Armstrong, by clicking on RICKIED at us.ibm.com in the e-meeting attendee list, and he will assist you. Today's presenter is David Britt. David has worked in support and development for the OS 390 and ZOS comm server product for 6 years and is currently an SME for the FTP and SNMP components. Today's topic is ZOS SNMP basics, principles of configuration and diagnostics for the SNMP environment. It will include a PowerPoint presentation followed by a question and answer session. During the presentation, all lines will be muted. After the presentation, I'll ask attendees to answer a few quick questions via e-meeting polling. After that, the lines will open for a question and answer period. If you're in the e-meeting, you will see the presentation. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to David.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the ZOS SNMP Basics presentation. We've got a lot of slides to cover today, so let's jump right in with the agenda on slide 2. Today we'll be going over the fundamental principles behind setting up an SNMP environment on the mainframe. We'll start by covering the basic concepts of an SNMP environment, including details on the interactions between various SNMP components and also the specifics of the SNMP V1 security model. Next, we'll discuss the two configuration files used in an SNMP V1 environment, which are the pw.source file and the snmptraff.dest file. We'll discuss using the ZOS Unix OSNMP commands to verify that the configuration is working as expected. And finally, we'll discuss how to troubleshoot problems with the configuration using the SNMP agent trace. Slide 3. This presentation is going to be the first in a multi-part series for SNMP. As the title indicates, today we'll only be covering the basics, essentially just the concepts of SNMP and some simple configuration schemas. In the second lecture, we'll delve into more advanced, more customized SNMP configurations. At that point, we'll also cover the more advanced SNMP V2C and SNMP V3 security models, as well as the more advanced configuration files, such as the osnmpd.data, mibs.data, and snmpd.conf files. Slide 4. The fundamental idea behind SNMP is to give a remote user the ability to manage a network and network-related application. This occurs by allowing a user to monitor network statistics and manage different values pertaining to the applications. These statistics and values exist in an SNMP component called the Management Information Base, or MIB. These are the values that are passed back and forth between the other SNMP components. As we proceed, you'll see that the other SNMP components, with the exception of the manager, support their own MIBs. The MIB is a collection of objects where each object is essentially one of the statistics or values that a user can monitor or manage. Each object can be referred to using two different names. One is a dotted numerical notation called the Object Identifier, or OID. The other is a textual name called the Object Descriptor. For example, let's consider the MIB object, which contains a system description, such as Level 2 Test System. When the SNMP components pass this value back and forth, they use the OID to refer to this value, which is 1.3.6.1.2.1.1. That's not very easy for us to remember, so humans can refer to the object using its textual descriptor, the sysdescr. Slide 5. Next, we have the SNMP agent. This is the primary SNMP component, and its main function is to forward requests back and forth between managers and subagents. It also supports its own small MIB, which contains values pertaining to the actual system and the agent itself. If you were to try to conceptualize an SNMP environment in a client-server perspective, the agent can be considered the server. The manager is what allows a remote user to generate requests to the SNMP agent. Back to the client-server perspective, this would be the client. The requests generated by the manager can be queries of objects in the various available MIBs or requests to set the value of some of the objects in the MIBs. Finally, the subagent is a component which supports a MIB, specific to a network-related application. By having a particular application subagent active, the values and information for that application can be made available to remote users. Since it's much easier to visualize components in an SNMP environment than to try and imagine them based on descriptions, we have on slide 6 a diagram of how the components interact. On this slide, we see a diagram of the relationships between managers, agents, and subagents. A lot of what we will discuss on this slide is actually contained on the next few slides, but it's easier to understand them while we're looking at the diagram. So we'll spend a little extra time on this slide and then sort of fast forward to the subsequent ones. In this example, we have three subagents active. Each subagent supports a MIB containing information about the respective application. The TCP/IP subagent supports a MIB which contains statistics and values related to the TCP/IP stack. These include, among other things, things like connection tables and interface tables. Similarly, the OMP route subagent supports a MIB which pertains to the OMP route application and includes things such as routing tables and statistics for each route. Finally, the OSA Express subagent supports a MIB pertaining to the OSA cards themselves. Note that these three subagents are only examples. Other ZOS communication server subagents are also shipped with the product and include things such as the Network Slap M2, SLA, and TN3270 Telnet subagents. Additionally, OEM products can ship their own subagents in order to make their vendor-specific MIBs available through the SNMP agent. I'd like to make a few points about the SNMP manager. First, note that the manager communicates with the agent using the User Datagram Protocol, or UDP. It's also important to understand that the manager communicates only with the SNMP agent. It never sends any requests to subagents, even when the objects being queried are owned by a subagent. Instead, all requests are sent to the agent, and the agent then determines if the request should be forwarded to a subagent, and if so, which one. So how does the agent know which subagent a request should be forwarded to? When a subagent connects to the agent, it does something called registering its MIB. This basically entails giving the agent a range of OIDs it supports. Remember, the OID is the numerical identification for an object in a MIB. So when an agent receives a request for a subagent-supported OID, it can identify which subagent registered the MIB containing the OID and can then forward the request onto the right place. One side note about subagents. They communicate with the agent using the Distributed Program Interface, or DPI. This can be done over a TCP or UDP connection, but the subagents shipped with the ZOS Comm Server product do this using a Unix socket. Slide 7. As I indicated earlier, we're going to skip through these slides as we've already discussed them. Slide 7 here iterates the subagents that were used in the example. Slide 8 talks about the DPI socket used by the subagents and about registering the MIB. Slide 9 discusses the information about the manager and how it communicates with the agent. Slide 10 To better understand the diagram we just looked at and the interaction between components, we'll now take a look at how a typical SNMP request is processed. Let's assume a user wants to know how many TCP connections are currently established on the system, and we'll use an SNMP manager to query this information. In step 1, we see that this value is maintained in an object called TCP cur estab, which has an OID listed. Next, in step 2, we see that the manager has generated a request to the SNMP agent using the OID of TCP cur estab. In the box below the SNMP agent, we see that the OID of TCP cur estab falls within one of the ranges that the TCP/IP subagent registered. So in step 3, the agent correlates the request with the TCP/IP subagent. And in step 4, the agent forwards this request onto the TCP/IP subagent. In step 5, the subagent obtains this value from the TCP/IP stack, and in step 6, sends it back to the agent. In step 7, the agent returns this response back to the manager. And finally, in step 8, the manager reports this value back to the user. Slide 11. Now that we understand the basic concepts of SNMP and how requests are processed, we'll discuss what kind of security is available to protect the information supported by the SNMP environment. There are three levels of security: SNMP V1, SNMP V2C, and SNMP V3. In this lecture, we'll only be discussing SNMP V1. SNMP V2C and SNMP V3 will be covered in the more advanced lectures. Slide 12. SNMP V1 is a community-based security environment, meaning that the agent is configured with different communities which are allowed to send requests. To define a community, the agent needs two things: the community name itself, which is something like a password, and a range of IP addresses which are associated with that community. Each request generated by a manager contains a community name, and the SNMP agent uses this to determine if the IP address from which the request was generated falls within the specified community. If it does not, the request is discarded. Slide 13. There are two configuration files specific to the SNMP V1 environment. The pw.source file is used to define the communities and IP address ranges. The SNMP trap.dest file, which we will discuss a little later, is used to define target hosts for delivering traps. One thing to note about using an SNMP V1 environment: all of the SNMP traffic between the manager and the agent is sent unencrypted. This means that everything in the request, including the objects being queried, the values of those objects, and even the community name with which the request is issued, are sent in clear text. Anyone who might be running a sniffer or packet trace will be able to capture and review this information. As such, the SNMP V1 security, for the most part, relies simply on the fact that, even though a community name may be known, a potentially malicious user would still have to have access to the local network, and to generate requests, he or she would have to be able to do so from one of the IP addresses within the community's range. Slide 14. In the pw.source file, as mentioned earlier, we define the communities used by the agent. It defines the community names and maps a range of IP addresses to each community. The file can contain multiple community names, one per line, each line using the syntax we see here. The community name is simply how the community is identified by the manager and is a case-sensitive string. The IP address and subnet mask work together to define the range of IP addresses associated with the community name. Slide 15. This is an example of a pw.source file. Notice the use of both host addresses, like the 10.11.12.13 address, and subnet addresses, like the 193.168.1.0 address. Basically, this example, to which we will be referring throughout the presentation, defines three communities from which requests will be accepted: the V1 subagent community, whose range consists only of a single IP address; the I use SNMP V1 community, whose range consists of any IP addresses from the 192.168.1.0 subnet; and the User 1 community, whose range consists of only the loopback address. Slide 16. This slide is more for reference than for discussion. Every ZOS comm server application has a standard search order which is used when locating configuration files. This happens to be the search order for the pw.source file. The first file found when traversing this search order is the one that will be used for the configuration. Slide 17. So how does the pw.source file work? I'll start by explaining the exact process, but because this can be confusing, we'll follow up with some examples. When the SNMP agent receives a request, it takes the request's community name and checks it against the communities that are defined in the pw.source file. Let me reiterate that the community names are case-sensitive, so mismatched cases within the community will result in an error. If the agent finds a match, it then checks to see if the IP address from which the request was generated is within the range defined for that community. For those of you who are familiar with bitwise operations, this is done using two steps: a bitwise logical AND followed by an exclusive OR. First, the agent applies the network match to the source IP address using the logical AND. Slide 18. The result of the AND is then compared to the IP address for the community name using an exclusive OR. If the result is zero, meaning that the IP addresses match exactly, then the manager's IP address is within the specified range and the request is accepted. To better understand this process, we'll use our example pw.source configuration to analyze three hypothetical requests. The first will be a request from loopback using community name user1. The second will be a request from 10.11.12.14 using community name v1 subagent. The last will be a request from 192.168.1.101 using the community name I use SNMP V1. Slide 19. Our first request from the loopback address uses community name user1 with a capital U. Again, because the community names are case sensitive, user1 does not match user1 with a lowercase u. As such, the agent does not recognize the community as one defined in the pw.source configuration. The request is discarded, and the manager will get a timeout error. Slide 20. Our second request is from 10.11.12.14, highlighted here in yellow. It uses community name v1 subagent. The agent will identify the v1 subagent community in its pw.source configuration, which we see here in the first italicized line. Next, the agent applies the specified network mask. Note that the mask is 255.255.255.255. In binary, this is all ones. So performing the logical AND does not actually change the source IP address at all, and the result, highlighted in blue, is still 10.11.12.14. The agent takes this result and performs the exclusive OR against the v1 subagent's IP address, highlighted in green. Because the two addresses do not match exactly, the result in red is non-zero. Note that there's a slight typo here. The result of the XOR would actually be 0.0.0.3. Regardless, the agent will discard this request and the manager times out. Slide 21. This slide also has a typo that I'd like to point out first. It indicates that our third request will be using community name V1 subagent. Actually, for our example, it's supposed to be using IU's SNMP V1. I'll fix both of these typos when I republish the tech doc a few days after this presentation. At any rate, this request is received from 192.168.1.101, again highlighted in yellow, and uses community name IU's SNMP V1. The agent will find this community in its pw.source configuration, seen on the first italicized line. It then applies the community's network mask to the request's source IP address. This time, note that the network's mask's last octet is 0, meaning that all of the bits on the last octet of the source IP address will be zeroed out. Therefore, the result of the AND, seen in blue, is 192.168.1.0. This is then compared to the community's IP address, seen in green, using the exclusive OR. Because the two addresses match, the result of the OR is 0, meaning that the IP address is within the range allowed for that community. The request will then be accepted in process. Slide 22. Slide 22. Can we advance to slide 22?
Slide, please.
22, please. There's one thing to point out about configuring the communities used by the agent. As noted previously, the subagents and the agent communicate over a DPI socket. The process of opening this connection and registering MIBs does not require any authentication or association with the community. However, before the subagents can connect to the agent using DPI, they have to find out what DPI sockets the agent has made available. Conveniently, this information is maintained by the agent in a series of MIB objects. In order to obtain this information, each subagent sends a query to the agent over the UDP socket using a community name just like any manager would do. In fact, the agent can't tell the difference between this query and a normal manager query. This one request by the subagent must be associated with the community and authenticated just like any other request. As such, there must be a community defined with the range of IP addresses that include the subagent's IP address, and the subagent must be configured to use the correct community name when querying the agent for DPI information. Otherwise, the subagent will not be able to obtain this information and won't be able to open a DPI connection to the agent. Slide 23. Now we'll discuss the SNMP trap.dest file. But first, we'll discuss exactly what a trap is. Unlike requests for objects, traps are actually alerts which the agent sends to managers. These are alerts only, so no reply would be sent by a manager upon receiving a trap. These alerts are used to notify the managers of various events which may occur on the network or within the SNMP environment. They can be generated by subagents or by the agent itself. Examples of traps an agent might generate include a cold start trap, which means the agent has initialized, or an authentication failure trap, which means that the agent received a request that could not be authenticated. Examples of traps that a subagent might generate are link up or link down traps, which would be generated by the TCP/IP subagent if a link went down or came up. Remember that subagents communicate only with the agent, So when the subagent generates a trap, it actually generates it to the agent, who then forwards it to the appropriate managers. Slide 24. In order for the agent to send traps out to different managers, we have to configure it with the different destinations to which a trap should be sent. We also have to tell it what transport to use when sending the trap. Note that the destinations are typically manager stations listening for traps on port 162. Also, UDP is currently the only transport that the DOS comm server SNMP agent supports when sending traps. We provide this information to the agent using the SNMP trap.dest file. Slide 25. The SNMP trap.dest file, like the pw.source file, can have multiple lines, each line having the syntax we see here. The destination or host IP can either be an IP address or a host name to which the trap is to be sent. The transport, as noted before, will always be UDP. Each time a trap is generated, one trap will be sent to each destination configured in the file. At the bottom of the slide, we see an example of an SNMP trap.dest file. In this example, every time a trap is generated by the agent or the subagent, the agent will actually send out two traps, one to 1011.12.13 and one to 192.168.1.101. Let's keep this example configuration in mind since we'll be referring back to it for the remainder of the presentation. Slide 26. Again, this slide is more for reference than for discussion. Like the pw.source file, there is a standard search order SNMP uses to locate the SNMP trap.dest file. This is pretty straightforward, so there will be no need to discuss it in depth. Slide 27. Once you've got a pw.source file and an SNMP trap.dest file configured on your system, you'll want to test it to make sure that it's working the way you intended. You can use any SNMP manager to do this testing, but the ZOS comm server product is shipped with a built-in manager, the ZOS Unix OSNMP command. This is a shell command which can perform basic manager requests and is intended primarily for testing purposes. It's not meant to do network management, as most other SNMP manager products are more robust, use automated processes, and can translate data into graphical output for a user. Slide 28. Here we see the syntax for the OSNMP command. As you can see, it can be a potentially complicated command, and this syntax is specific only for GET and GETNEXT requests. There are other requests which the OSNMP command can generate which require even more syntaxes. However, for our testing purposes, we don't need to use all of these options and can use a much more simplified version of the command seen on slide 29. In this command, the -v flag tells OSNMP to output the results in a verbose format. Essentially, instead of outputting the responses using the OID, this will cause it to actually use the object's textual descriptor. This just makes the output a little easier for us to read and understand. The -h hostname parameter tells the OSNMP command where to send the request. This can be the IP address or the hostname where the SNMP agent is running. The -c community name parameter specifies what community the agent should use to authenticate the request. The getNext is the type of request we'll be issuing. Finally, the MIB variable is the actual MIB object which we will be requesting. We'll start by testing our community configurations. For each community, we'll send one request to the agent. The request we generate will be a query for the system description object, sysdesker. In each example, we expect the agent to respond back with a value of level 2 test system. We'll also assume in these examples that the agent is running on the 10.11.12.13 host, and that will determine how and where each OSNMP command is executed. Slide 30. First, we'll test the V1 subagent community. You'll recall from our pw.source file that the IP address range for this community includes only the 10.11.12.13 address. Therefore, the command has to be issued from the 10.11.12.13 host. Because we'll be executing this command from the same host that the agent is running on, we won't need to specify the -h parameter to specify the request destination. If no -h parameter is specified, the OSNMP command simply defaults to the local host. This leaves us with the command we see below, and if everything is set up correctly, we'll get the indicated response. Note that the OSNMP's output uses the sysdesker.0 object descriptor. This is because we use the -v verbose flag. Without that flag, the response would have been output using the OID. Also note that, in this test, as well as in the next two, you may want to consider testing the negative case. This can be done by issuing the command using a bad community name or from a host other than 10.11.12.13. If you receive a timeout, you'll know that the SNMP agent is correctly discarding requests which don't have the proper community credentials. Slide 31. Next, we'll test the iUse SNMP V1 community. Remember that our pw.source file configuration associated this community name with any IP address from the 192.168.1.0 subnet. So for this test, the request must be issued from a host within this subnet. Because the agent, running on 10.11.12.13, is not within this subnet, the OSNMP command will be issued from a different system. So we'll have to use the -h parameter to tell the OSNMP command where to send the request. We see our command and our response here at the bottom of the slide. Again, you can do negative testing by using a bad community name or by issuing the command from a host outside of the 192.168.1.0 subnet. Slide 32. Finally, we'll test the user1 community. Because this community only includes the loopback address, the testing must again be done on the 10.11.12.13 host. However, remember that if no -h parameter is used, the request will be sent to the local host and will use the local host address as its source. The agent will not consider the local host address to be the same as the loopback address. So in this case, we can again use the -h parameter to tell the OSNMP command to send the request to loopback. As a result, the request source IP address will be loopback as well. Slide 33. The OSNMP command can also be used to listen for traps. So we can use it to test our SNMP trap.desk configuration as well. Syntax you see here shows how to invoke the command as a trap listener. By executing this command on the destinations listed in the SNMP trap.desk file, which were 10.11.12.13 and 192.168.1.101, we can verify if a trap is delivered to that host. The output of the listener will be written to standard out, and an example of the output is seen on slide 34. You can see here the command used to invoke the OSNMP manager such that it listens for traps. In this example, note the ampersand at the end of the command. This isn't actually part of the OSNMP syntax, but rather tells the OMVS shell to run the command in the background and can be ignored. With this command running on one of the target hosts listed in the SNMP trap.desk file, we can start the SNMP agent on the 10.11.12.13 host to generate a cold start trap. Again, this is a trap which simply informs managers that the agent has become active. You can see in the output that we have received a trap, and the agent address is 10.11.12.13, so we know it came from the agent we just started. The generic trap field also tells us that this is, in fact, a cold start trap. Slide 35. So what happens if our testing doesn't go quite as well as it did in our examples? We need a method of easily troubleshooting our configuration. And a good way to do this is to activate an SNMP agent trace, which shows what configuration is being used and why an error might have occurred. To demonstrate how to use this trace, we will consider it in light of three common errors encountered when configuring the SNMP agent, which we see listed here. The first is that a query using the OSNMP command results in the message EZZ3310I timeout after 3 seconds. The second is that the response output by the OSNMP command is OID equal no such name, where OID is the MIB object which has been requested. Finally, the third common error we will review is that no traps are received at the target host. Before we look at these errors, however, we'll learn what the SNMP trace capabilities are and how the trace can be activated. Slide 36. You'll see here the 8 different levels of agent tracing. Levels 1, 2, and 4 cover most of the interaction between the agent and manager. Levels 8 and 16 cover the communication between the agent and the subagent. The remaining levels give additional details about the internal process of the SNMP application. Slide 37. Activating one trace level does not activate all the levels below it, so specifying a trace level of 4 does not also activate levels 1 and 2. Instead, to activate multiple trace levels, we simply activate a trace level equal to the sum of the desired levels. So to enable levels 1, 2, and 4, we would actually activate trace level 7. Note that activating trace level 255 will turn on all of the trace levels. There are two ways in which the SNMP agent trace can be activated. One way is to dynamically start the trace using the modify command we see here, where SNMP job name is the SNMP agent started task, and the number sign is the desired trace level. However, in order to get the most information out of the agent's configuration, we will need to activate the trace at the SNMP agent startup. This is done using the -d parameter when starting the agent. Slide 38. We see here an example of the JCL used to start OSNMPD, which is the SNMP agent. If OSNMPD is started from the ZOS Unix shell, we also have an example of using the -d parameter from the Unix command. Note that we specify on these examples a level of 255, which, as noted before, turns on all levels of tracing. This will output a high volume of trace messages, so you must exercise caution when using this high of a level anywhere other than a testing environment. Slide 39. We'll start by looking at the timeout error. These are the most common, as they can be caused by many different situations. For the same reason, they can also require the most troubleshooting efforts. We'll go through five simple steps that will help resolve most of the timeout errors. To begin the troubleshooting process, we will assume that we have already recreated the problem with the trace running. The first thing we need to do is ensure that the manager's request actually reached the SNMP agent. We can search the trace for the string "received an SNMP packet on." This message is output any time the agent receives a packet from the manager. Slide 40. We see here an example of what a received request looks like in the trace. If this message is not contained anywhere in the trace, then we know that the request never arrived at the agent. In this situation, additional troubleshooting will have to be done on the network segment between the agent's and manager's hosts, as the problem does not exist within the realm of the SNMP environment. Slide 41. If we do find a message indicating that a request was received, the first thing we need to do is check for an authentication failure. The message we see here at the bottom is an example of what these failures look like in the agent trace. Slide 42. If you see an authentication failure, start by checking the community name which is being used by the manager against the community name that is specified in the PW.source file. Remember, these strings are case sensitive. You should also check to see if the IP address and subnet masks are specified correctly. Slide 43. Authentication failures can also occur if the community name is correct, but the request has a source IP address outside of the range associated with that community. Check the IP address seen on the message indicating the request was received. It should fall within the range specified for that community name. Slide 44. If we find that the address is not within the specified range, then either the community configuration in the PW.source file must be altered to include that address, or the manager needs to be changed to ensure that the correct source IP address is used. Slide 45. If we determine that the correct community is used and that the request source IP address falls within the range associated with that community, then it's possible that the PW.source file has a syntax or configuration error which has prevented the configuration from being used by the subagent. If this is the case, a message similar to the EZZ6209I message we see here will have been written near the beginning of the trace when SNMP was initializing. Note that EZZ6209I is not the only message which might be seen. The possible messages range from EZZ6207I to EZZ6218I. The text of the message will indicate what portion of the configuration is incorrect. From that, the line should be corrected, the agent should be restarted to incorporate the change, and the environment should be retested. Slide 46. Finally, it's possible that we've configured one PW.source file, but another one is getting used by the SNMP agent. Near the beginning of the trace, an EZZ6266I message is issued indicating which file is being used for the PW.source configuration. Check this message to ensure that the file being used is the one which you have configured. If it is not, then the correct file should either be renamed such that it precedes the file being used in the search order, or the configuration from the configured file should be moved to the file being used, or finally, if the file being used does not contain important information, it can simply be deleted. Slide 47. The next common problem we'll consider is the return of a no-such-name value. This means that the MIB object requested is not one which is recognized by the SNMP agent. Though there may be other reasons this has occurred, this most commonly happens when a manager is requesting an object supported by a subagent which is not yet connected to the agent. This may be because the subagent has not been started, or that the subagent cannot connect to the agent. In many cases, we find that the subagent encounters authentication problems when trying to query the agent for the DPI information needed to create the initial connection. Slide 48. This error can be investigated much in the same way we investigated the timeout error. First, you can search the trace for the SNMP return code not authenticated error or the return code equal negative 14. If this is found, check the community name and the IP address on the subagent's request and see if they match the PW.source configuration. You can also check that there are no configuration errors in the PW.source file and that the correct PW.source file is being used. One side note, if you don't find any authentication errors, it could be possible that you forgot to start the SNMP subagent. Slide 49. There are three common reasons traps may not be generated to the desired destinations. If the trap that is not getting delivered is actually an authentication failure trap, check the value of MIB object SNMP enable authentraps.0. If this value is set to 2, the agent will not send out authentication failure traps. You can set this value to 1 using the OSNMP command we see listed here. Also note that the agent can be configured to automatically set this value to 1 on startup using the osnmpd.data file. However, we will discuss this in the more advanced SNMP configuration lecture. Also, though I didn't include it on this slide, you may encounter the same type of error with a link up or a link down trap. In that particular case, the MIB object if link up down trap enabled must be set to 1. Slide 50. Similar to the pw.source file, configuration errors in the SNMP trap.def file will cause the configuration not to be used. These errors will be marked by the same EZZ messages near the beginning of the trace. You can use the message text to correct the error and restart the agent. Slide 51. Again, similar to the pw.source file, the wrong SNMP trap.def file may be used by the SNMP agent. The same steps that were used with the pw.source file can again be used to correct this problem. Slide 52. This concludes the SNMP basics presentation. Before moving into the question and answer block, I would like to take this opportunity to point out some additional WebSphere product resources. This chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information. The events link on support pages points you to webcast and conference information. Visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up the learning curve quickly. The ESR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Support link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products which are of interest to you. Now I'll turn the presentation back over to our moderator, Kristen.
Thank you, David, for a great presentation. Now we would like to conduct a short poll. Questions will appear in the e-meeting. Your participation is greatly appreciated. The first question is, on a scale of 1 to 5, choose the number that best describes how you feel about this statement. The information presented today was useful to me. Please enter 1 if you strongly agree, 2 if you agree, 3 for neutral, 4 if you disagree, and 5 if you strongly disagree. We'll wait another moment to give people a chance to answer. The second question is, on a scale of 1 to 5, choose the number that best describes how you feel about this statement. The material was well organized and clearly presented. Please enter 1 if you strongly agree, 2 if you agree, 3 for neutral, 4 if you disagree, and 5 if you strongly disagree. Question 3. Did this call meet your training expectations? Please enter 1 for yes and 2 for no. Next, please provide us with comments to help improve future webcasts. And finally, is there a topic you would like to see scheduled? We welcome any ideas that you may have. Thanks again for your participation. At this point, Steve, we would like to open the lines for questions. I will turn it over to the presenter now.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question or have a comment, press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. Please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 for questions or comments. And we'll go first to Jeff Beach.
Hello, this is Jeff Beach Garwood. Not a technical question, but procedural question. My same time connection kept failing, so I didn't get to see any of this presentation, I'm afraid. Are you going to be representing it, perhaps, or are you aware of any issues with same time right now?
Hi, actually, I will answer that question. This is Christy, the moderator. You may access the presentation by going to any IBM.com site and typing 7007146 in the search box at the black section at the very top of the page. And just to remind you that within 24 to 48 hours, an MP3 file and presentation will be available on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. So the presentation and the MP3 file will be there, and you can hear and view the presentation at that time.
I will do that, thank you. But it might be worth checking with any other attendees whether they had problems or if I was the only one. I just kept getting connection failures, retrying, hanging, all sorts of things. But I know I can use same time because I've used it before.
And we'll go next to John Arneson.
Hello, Dr. Britt.
Hi, John.
I was curious, back on slide number 10, you were talking about OIDs and the ranges of values, and I was just curious if you could talk a little bit about more how that works. I didn't quite understand how.
This is something that we'll get a little deeper into in the more advanced topic, but essentially the MIB, the objects in a MIB are arranged in a tree structure, and that structure is defined by the decimated numerals. So, for example, a subtree, if you're looking at slide 10, and you've got the test system value, which is assigned to the OID 1.3.6.1.2.1.1.1, which is the sysdesker. That is actually part of a MIB subtree, and you can access all of the OIDs in that or all the objects within that particular MIB subtree simply by the common prefix of 1.3.6.1.2.1.
Is that a set length, that common prefix, or is that just how far you've gone down the tree?
That's just how far you've gone down the tree. You basically got two types of objects. One is a scalar, and one is an entry, a table entry. So a scalar are things that, for example, like the sysdesker, where there's only one particular object for an entire set of supported MIBs. There's only one sysdesker, so you would refer to that actually as sysdesker.0. Now, the table entries are, for example, if you've got something like the TCP connection table, which could be of a varying size depending on how many TCP connections you have at any given time. So what you have is a set of predefined objects, and then more instances of those objects are created for each TCP connection. I'm not sure if that helps explain it any or not. Am I close here? Or?
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. I had just one other question.
Sure.
On the slides you were doing your SNMP commands, I think it was slide 30, I was just curious why you did a get next instead of a get.
That goes back to the difference between the scalar and the table entry type objects. When you do a get command, you have to specify exactly what the OID is. So if you've got a scalar, that's where it would end with the .0. So if you use that same command to do a get for the sysdesker, you would actually have to do a get on sysdesker.0. However, when you do a get next command, what it does is identify the beginning of the OID and then goes and finds the first valid instance of any object that follows that particular OID number. So if you did a get on sysdesker, it would actually return sysdesker.0 because that is the first valid instance. This is mostly used when you're dealing with objects in a table. So, for example, if you query the table and it returned entry .1, you don't really know how many entries are in that table. So if you did a get on entry .2, it might fail because there may only be one entry in that table. However, if you did a get next on entry .1, if there was an entry .2, it would return entry .2. And then you could do a get next on entry .2, and if there were an entry .3, it would return entry .3. Now, if it returns something other than entry .3, then the manager would know that you have now gone beyond the limits of that table, and it would report back to you essentially that you've already walked through the entire table. And that is literally called walking a tree. When you do a walk command using the OSNMP manager, it simply does a series of get next requests until it gets a value back that is outside of the requested tree.
Okay, so the get is for a specific instance, and the walk is for the whole tree.
Right.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
And we'll go next to Patrick O'Keefe.
Thank you. I have both a comment and a question. The comment is that webcasts are blocked at my shop, so I'm really glad that you had the PDF format presentation out there and that I could find it. I hope you continue doing that. The presentation was good even for without being able to actually see it. Too bad that the caller who kept dropping his connection didn't know about the PDF format of the slides. That was real helpful. Anyway, my question for the OSNMP command, what maps MIB names to the OID, and is there any way to add additional, like if a brand X product has enterprise MIBs, is there any way to make the OSNMP command know about those?
Yes. As for the MIBs that are shipped with the ZOS ComServer product, the mappings from the textual name to the OID is actually built into the code for the OSNMP command. So it automatically knows when you say sysdesker that you're asking for 1.3.6. so on and so forth. As for enterprise-specific MIBs that may come with some OEM product, there is a configuration file called the MIBS.data file. And in that file, you can specify an OID, its corresponding textual name, and the type of value, such as octet or integer or gauge or counter or something of that nature, that can be expected to be returned with that request. That way, when, let's say, for example, you have a product that has an OID of 1.4, which would be very strange, but just for simplicity, we'll say 1.4. And let's say that the name of that particular OID, or at least the name you wanted to use to refer to it, was this object. You could put in a line in your MIBS.data file that said 1.4, this object, and then whatever kind of object it was. We'll say integer 32. So when you go to the OSNMP command and say do a get on this object, he's going to go look in his compiled information and say, well, I don't know what that is. But then he'll look in the information he read in from the MIBS.data file and say, oh, that's 1.4. He'll send that off to the agent. The agent will find the value from whichever subagent is supporting it, or return it back. The OSNMP command will back into his configuration and say, that's going to be of type integer 32, so when he outputs it to the user, it'll show up correctly.
So that MIBS.data file gets read every time the OSNMP command is issued?
Correct. Basically, the OSNMP command, when you execute that command, it starts up and shuts down every time. It's its own Unix thread. So every time it starts up, it has to read in its configurations, and when it shuts down again, it releases them.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
As a reminder, press star 1 on your touchtone phone for questions or comments. We'll go next to Larry Milan.
Are these IP addresses V4 only, or do you support IPv6?
IPv6 is supported by the SNMP agent. I'm trying to remember which release we began that support. I think it was we began some support in 1.4 and then have continued adding in support throughout the ongoing releases, 1.5 and 1.6. There are some new MIBs that are not IBM MIBs. They're actually MIBs that are defined by RFCs that are still in a draft state, but include IPv6 addresses. But we do use those as of V1R6. And we've also created some corresponding enterprise-specific MIBs that we ship in V1R6 that also incorporate IPv6 addresses.
Again, star 1 for questions or comments. We'll go next to Vern Dixon.
Yes, I'm really in a real difficult situation. I'm in a PC lockdown situation, so when you folks come up and say, do you want to install same time meeting, whatever the name of it is, I'm dead at that point. So I've been listening on the telephone to the script as read, and I have no idea what was on slides or any of that kind of information. That's the front-end information and trying to get in. Do you want to make a comment about that? I got another question.
Vern, I think the best thing in that situation would be to, at this point, just to obtain the MP3 file when it's made available and go back through the presentation with the PDF. It should be functionally the same, with the exception of there will be no Q&A session at the end.
Okay. Is the script that you were reading going to be recorded with the MP3 file separately from the MP3 file or whatever?
I believe the MP3 file will just be the discussion we're having right now. I don't know. Christy, am I allowed to make the script available on the tech doc?
Hi, yes. The entire presentation, and I believe the question and answer session as well, is included in the MP3 file. So you will be able to hear the entire session that way through the website. And you can follow along with the paging of the slides with the PDF file.
Okay, one more question. None of the documentation that I have seen on the installation, discussion, introduction, red books, anything whatsoever that I've seen on SNMP, never discusses anything except NetView for doing any kind of queries or anything with a management tool. All of the books, manuals, whatever, stop at the point in the install process where the installation and interfacing with NetView is done. Is there any intention whatsoever of documenting anything that has anything to do with something other than NetView?
Well, I believe NetView is the primary management application that IBM ships. We do. The only other thing that we have that we ship with our product is the OSNMP command, and that is documented in the IP System Administrator command reference. But again, that's not really intended for actual management of the network. That's more of a basic shell script or shell command that's used for testing purposes. I have seen people that have written shell scripts to use the OSNMP command that get fairly elaborate in their management processes, but we don't ship any other management type of stuff with the ComServer product. And again, as I indicated previously, I believe the primary one primary product for network management from IBM for the mainframe is the NetView product. Any other type of manager would be some type of OEM product.
Okay, that's it.
Again, that's star one for questions or comments. We have a follow-up question. Larry Malam.
Yes, I've been hearing a reference to the PDF file for this presentation, and I guess I missed that. Is there anything about it that a non-IBMer can get a hold of that?
Sure. In the next 24 to 48 hours, an MP3 file and presentation will be available on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. So that is the PDF file of the presentation as well as the MP3 file, so you can hear the presentation.
I see.
And that will be available on the site.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And having no further questions, I'd like to turn the call over to Christy Snyder for any additional or closing comments.
Thank you. At this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. Remember, a replay of this presentation will be available on the WebSphere Technical Exchange site within the next day or two. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will also be announced on this site. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, David, for presenting today.
This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.